Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and as always, I'm glad you could join me for a little bit of cardboard conversation, or scratch that, conversation about cardboard. I guess if you're talking about just plain old cardboard, it's not really all that entertaining. Unless you're in the industry, you know, you make cardboard boxes for a living, I guess it's shop talk. But no, we're talking about classic cardboard, baseball cards, of course. And we've got an interesting show today, as it's one of those shows that sparked from an idea that when the idea popped into my head, I went, that's a great idea. Why didn't I think of that before? Has that ever happened to you? You get this great idea and you go, this is it. I'm going to do this. Yeah, let's go. Why didn't I think of this before? It's like, this was such a good idea. It was so obvious. I should have done something about it at some other time. But alas, we finally got around to it. And it all started not too long ago. A gentleman who listens to the program named Nick Deonti reached out to me and offered to be a guest on the program. And this is not all that unusual. And just so that we don't have random people just trying to get on the show, I was talking to Nick through several DMs on Twitter, and I said, well, what do you do? And you know, what's kind of the story that we discuss here? And as you will find out, Nick does a lot in his life. He is a baseball card collector. He has written blogs about him. He has done podcasts about him, still does. And one of the neat things Nick does is he reviews products for Topps baseball cards. Doesn't that sound like a dream job? You get every few weeks in the mail, you get a box of cards from Topps, and they're asking, can you please take a look at this and offer up your opinions on the product? So we said, hey, let's talk a little bit about that. Let's talk about some of the new Topps products that are out there. And I know this product, or this podcast rather, often discusses old cards, but we like to weave in the new every now and then. I like to touch on it because even if you're a collector of older baseball cards, you still have a finger on the pulse. Even if you're not buying the latest Topps base set, you're probably still taking up the Topps living set, or maybe like me, you're, you know, really buying into Topps heritage or whatever. And speaking of Topps heritage, I said, Nick, let's talk a little bit about the new heritage set, which was released this past week. And we'll talk about your thoughts about it and the overall conversation on the podcast. We'll not only feature my interview with Nick, but also we'll take a look back at the 1970 Topps set, which is at the heart of the design of the 2019 Topps Heritage set. And, you know, it all worked out together. And I thought, that's a really good idea. We get to touch on the new product a little bit, and we also get to reach back in time and look at the set that really, you know, is being brought to the front and center by Topps through this heritage release. And then it dawned on me, this is where you go, oh, that's a great idea. And two, well, why didn't I think of that before? I realized, why didn't I think of that in the, 3 years I've been doing this podcast? Why didn't I think of taking the new heritage release and looking back at the original sets? So missed opportunity with 1967, 68, and 69 Topps, as those would represent the 16, 17, and 18 heritage sets. So I'm sure at some point, future podcast, I may backtrack a little bit and go, you know, oh, you know, let's look back at these, you know, late 60s sets, because those sets, while design-wise they don't stand out, and that's certainly the case for 1970, while design-wise they don't stand out, they do have some legendary rookie cards. They were also, you know, big in the changing times of baseball and baseball card collecting. And as we'll discuss in a little bit about 1970 Topps set, it was a changing time in America. And I am still fascinated by the way that you can look at baseball cards and especially cards from the past and link up their designs and the pluses and minuses with how history was playing out. Of course, you can't necessarily do that with new releases. You have to, you know, have the benefit of hindsight being 2020 and looking at a baseball card from 20, 30, 40 years ago and trying to pick apart how the cards were designed then and how they actually represented the times rather well. And that is something, as I've mentioned before, Topps went out of their way back in the 60s and 70s, especially to design cards that were representative of the times. And 1970 Topps actually did that. And I will explain why the rather dull, conservative, gray border look is really a good timestamp of the year 1970 and the game of baseball and American history. So we'll do that in just a moment. But before we talk about 1970 Topps and we get into our interview with Nick about the heritage set and his path into the hobby and reviewing products for Topps, a quick reminder that Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday. We drop the podcast at noon Eastern, and you can get that by subscribing via iTunes, also iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, Spotify, Google Play, and of course our home base, which is at Audio Boom. And a reminder, if you listen via Audio Boom, and that's the home base of our podcast, that's the link that we send out on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. It goes back to the Audio Boom feed. If you're listening on Audio Boom and you want to download the podcast, simply take the URL of the podcast, add .mp3 to it, and then you will be able to download the podcast and save it and listen to it whenever you wish. Now, since it comes out every other Friday now, you can go ahead and mark your calendar for our next podcast, which will be on its way on Friday, March 22nd. Now, that's going to be a tricky podcast for me because I will actually be on vacation that week. So I may have to put something in the can a little bit in advance. So if I know ahead of time what the program is going to be about, I will let you know. But look for that on March 22nd. And I apologize in advance if the show is a little shorter than normal, just because, again, I will be actually cruising through the mountains of Tennessee during that time. But we still want to deliver the podcast on time, especially since the baseball season starts right around the corner. In fact, the middle of the following week is when the season gets underway, and always an exciting time of year for baseball fans when the spring training wraps up and the games that count start going. So again, the next podcast, noon Eastern, Friday, March the 22nd, and it will continue to be delivered via all those channels every other Friday at noon Eastern. As I mentioned, the Twitter channel, if you will, the Twitter feed is at Wax and Gum Stains. We always appreciate your participation in bringing the hobby talk to our Twitter feed. And I want to give a shout out to several of our listeners who have made cash contributions to the program via our PayPal account. That is paypal.me/waxecstatic. And in particular, I want to give a shout out to David Moody, who has made several cash contributions before and made another one this week. And David also made several interesting request for the program. And by the way, David, I always appreciate any comments, suggestions, questions you have. Don't be shy. Don't think you're irritating me or bothering me by showering me with all these questions and suggestions. I will warn you, I may make you an executive producer of the program, which pays just as well as being the host of the program, which is nothing, by the way. But you do have some great suggestions and comments that I will weave into a future podcast. In fact, David was the inspiration for our podcast on the 75 Topps mini set from a few episodes ago. So David made another cash contribution. Once again, he is saving your skin, listeners, by making that cash contribution. He is not allowing me to open up the 89 Bowman rack pack that I bought for a dollar at a card show recently. I am dangling that carrot there. If we don't get cash contributions, I may unleash the Kraken. That is 89 Bowman, and force you to listen to a podcast featuring that wonderful set. So every cash contribution keeps the Bowman cards away, at least for another couple of weeks. And again, you can make that donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And again, when we beg for money or ask for donations, even if it's just $5, every little bit counts. And if you can give more, that's great. If you can't give, okay, that's fine. But make sure you get the word out there that we are seeking the support of our listeners. And again, any cash contribution goes right back into the program. It does not go into my pocket. It does not seed my kids' college education funds. It does not pay for that lavish vacation I'm about to take. Lavish being a rather loose term there. But it goes right back into the program in two ways. One, it keeps our archive and our operations at Audio Boom and all the connected channels going. So from a technical standpoint, it keeps the program up and running. And from a content standpoint, it helps too, because the cash will be used to the purchase of cards that we discuss on the show. So the purchase of the Topps Heritage cards that I made recently that we're going to discuss on the show. I may actually, because as I'll tell you, I ended up getting a hot box. So several of the really valuable refractor cards I'm probably going to put up for sale and bring in a few dollars and put it back into the program. So that's part of it. The 1978 Topps Wax Pack we opened up in our previous episode, that was made possible through listener donations. And there is a card show coming up here actually next weekend I'm going to try to get out to. And, you know, again, we may be able to pick up some junk wax. We may be able to pick up some great cards from the 60s and 70s and maybe early 80s and discuss them on the program here. So make those contributions again at paypal.me/waxecstatic and know that every penny that you send our way is going right back into the program, and it'll keep it going for a very, very long time. Now, 1970 Topps, we're going to talk about that set, and I want to set this up by talking about the 2019 Topps Heritage set. And if you are a longtime listener of the podcast, you know I'm a big fan of the Topps Heritage set. And even though I've not been a huge fan of the 1970 set, I am a big fan of Heritage. And it stems back to my days as a teenager when I collected vintage cards. And that was actually the one common thread. Even when I wasn't buying new baseball cards in the, you know, mid-90s through, you know, the early to mid-2000s, I would still occasionally buy cards from the 50s and 60s and 70s. And it wasn't just baseball. It was hockey. It was football. It was basketball. Even though I didn't really care much for new releases, I was still going out and buying lots of old cards or some old packs and still kind of keeping a toe in the water in the hobby by doing that. So the new Heritage set comes out last week, and I go to my local Walmart and Target, and there's no cards out yet. And even though it was the retail release day, they just hadn't been put on the shelves. So late Saturday night, I am coming home from work, and there's a Walmart not that far from my house. It's like a 2 or 3 minute drive from my house. And even though it is midnight as I'm coming home from work, I go, you know what? Let me swing by Walmart real quick and see if they've got the Heritage there. Why not? It's already late. I'm not going to crawl into bed until 12:30, 12:45 anyways. So I go by Walmart, which is always an adventure at midnight on a Saturday night. Thankfully, I didn't have to meet and greet too many Walmartians, as a friend of mine calls them. So, you know, I was able to go straight to the cards, which in this particular store is located right up near the front, near the self-checkout. So I was able to get in and get out pretty quickly. But I show up at the little lane that's got the cards, and sure enough, they have stocked up on some Topps Heritage. And in my excitement of finally getting my hands on the product, but also learning a lesson last year thanks to the 6,000 variations of Shea Ohtani cards in the Heritage set. I basically blew my monthly budget all in one midnight shopping trip to Walmart and picked up, a couple of jumbo packs, a couple of the box, the 9-pack boxes that you get. And, I'm going through the single packs, going through the jumbo packs, and I open up the boxes, and it turns out I get a hot box. And the hot box, of course, are the packs that have, there's a refractor card in each. There's insert cards as well. Nothing of high value in the sense of, didn't get one of those 1 in 5,000 pack inserts. But I did get some really nice refractor cards and some of the great inserts that also mirror the inserts from 1970. And overall, the Heritage set, I really enjoy it. I will be spending some time looking at all of the various variations, but it is a set where even if you're not a huge fan of 1970 Topps, I think you will like the effort that Topps put out to kind of recreate all of the 1970 Topps set and featuring, today's stars and, of course, some of the inserts and quirks and error cards and things that we look for in today's baseball cards. Now, the original 1970 Topps set was a monster at 720 cards at that time, the largest Topps set ever made. And there's a couple reasons why. First of all, you had the expansion of 1969, so you had to add, if you created, say, 25 cards of each team, with four teams coming into baseball in 1969, well, there's another 100 cards being added to the set. And as opposed to 1969, where you're basically just covering the players who were drafted in the expansion draft for these teams, well, by 1970, you had an honest-to-goodness roster of players from the previous season, players who were wearing the uniforms of the Padres and the Expos and the Royals and the Seattle Pilots. So Topps was able to expand on that. So by necessity, you had to expand the set because, baseball had expanded and you had to represent these other four teams. Another part of the expansion is the debut of the playoff cards because of the expansion of 1969 and the addition of the league division series, the league championship series, because you had two divisions, you had an extra round of playoffs. So in order to recap the ALCS and the NLCS, and later the World Series, Topps would introduce the playoff cards in 1970 Topps, which is rather unique. So that expanded the size of the set as well. But there was an economic purpose, too. As Topps is creating more and more of these cards, there's more production cost out there, and they had to raise the cost of a pack. Now, in 1969, a pack of Topps baseball cards cost 5 cents, and the 5-cent sticker price was part of Topps for a very long time, I think throughout the 1960s and maybe even going back into the late 50s. It was a nickel for a pack of cards. Well, in 1970, the price jumped to 10 cents. Now, we look at it nowadays and we go, wait a minute, if I could get a pack of 1970 Topps cards for 10 cents, are you kidding me? The price of a pack doubled from one year to another. So imagine spending $1.99 on a pack of Topps cards now and next year being asked, all right, for $3.99, you can get your 8 cards in one pack. No, you're not going to do that. You kidding me? So this was sticker shock in 1970. And let's also keep in mind that the economy as a whole in the United States, while certainly not in the dire straits of the mid-70s, was teetering just a little bit in 1970. So the inflation of the cost of baseball cards was a little bit of sticker shock to baseball card collectors at the time, which were mostly kids, of course. And it took people aback a little bit. Topps tried to market it. If you look at a pack of or a box of 1970 Topps, it says, you know, big yellow dot on the box says 10 cards, 10 cents. So that's how they marketed it. It was, hey, you're still getting a card for a penny a piece. So that was the marketing approach, but still it kind of threw people for a loop there. Now, the cards that came in the 1970 Topps set were not exactly the best design or a favorite design of collectors then and now. In fact, they're kind of bland. The grayish silver border. You had in kind of a little script at the bottom, the player's name. You had the player's position. And then you had in block letters up in the corner, you had the name of the team. And that was it. The front of the 1970 Topps cards are not very innovative or creative. Very conservative. Nothing too wild about them. And in fact, 1970 Topps is one of the few sets where most collectors actually enjoy the back of the card more than the front. And I'm one of those. I've always thought the back of 1970 Topps was more appealing than the front. And if you flip a 1970 Topps card over, you'll see that the white card stock jumps out at you with a gold, kind of a bright yellow gold background and dark blue text. And that combination of blue and gold on top of the white cardstock really stands out. So a lot of times when people are looking through stacks of 1970 Topps cards, they look at the back more than they do the front, which is a little surprising, but the back is much more appealing to the eye than the front of the card. Now, one observation, 1970 Topps actually somewhat mirrors the design of what would become the 1991 Leaf set. Silver borders and, you know, very square, very conservative, very basic. Not to say that Leaf was totally inspired by 1970 Topps, but you can see some parallels there. And while the design is lacking for 1970 Topps, at the same time, the rookie class isn't quite there. You go back to some of the releases in the late 1960s, you had the Nolan Ryan rookie card. You had Reggie Jackson. You had Steve Carlton. You had Tom Seaver. You had all of these big name rookie cards. In 1970, it was Thurman Munson, who of course is a big name, but in terms of big name, high value rookie cards, it drops off significantly afterwards. Really, the other top rookies in that set are Vida Blue and Bill Buckner, players who had fine careers, but not quite Reggie Jackson or Steve Carlton or Nolan Ryan, you know, some of the bigger names that came out in the previous 3 or 4 years. Now, there is another notable rookie card, although it's not a true rookie card, but a lot of people do consider it a rookie card. And yes, even though it is a dreaded manager card, we do like to tip the cap to the late George Sparky Anderson, who is airbrushed out in this card. In fact, he looks rather brown in this card. That's because in 1969, Sparky was a coach for the San Diego Padres, while in 1970, he became the manager of the Cincinnati Reds, and of course, the rest is history. Now, this is a manager rookie card for Sparky Anderson, but savvy collectors know that Sparky Anderson had a true rookie card as a player in 1959, and he had another card in 1960. So even though he had a very, very brief career as a player with the Philadelphia Phillies, his player rookie card comes from those sets. But a lot of people collect his manager rookie card. And as much as I joke about the dreaded manager cards, this is one of those neat cards to have. And I actually have a Sparky Anderson 71 Topps card. So a second year manager card, I guess you could say. And it is kind of neat because, of course, Sparky was legendary, not only in Cincinnati, but later in Detroit. So you can look for that. And I mentioned before that Topps, by design, made their cards represent the times, and I really think they do that in 1970. And here's why. When you think of the 1960s, you think of the turmoil, you think of Vietnam, you think of the Beatles, you think of John F. Kennedy. You know, in 1960, when the decade was starting, there was so much promise. You're coming out of the, you know, the glory days of the late 1950s and the Dwight Eisenhower era, and here comes John F. Kennedy, and you know, the baby boomer generation is coming of age, and you know, we're going to the moon, and the Peace Corps has started. There's just endless possibilities. You know, America is just rolling. And then, of course, you have the Kennedy assassination. You've got the civil rights uprisings. You've got the Vietnam War going on. You've got, you know, the RFK and MLK assassinations. You know, 1968 in and of itself was such a landmark year in American history. And you have this, you know, total 180 from 1960 to 1969. But at the same time, you know, you felt like there was some kind of cultural movement going on in the late 1960s. We think of Swinging London. You think of, you know, Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. You think of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. You think of, you know, Revolution. You know, that was, I mean, the Beatles had a song called that from the White Album. You know, it's Revolution. Actually, I had two songs. So, you know, you're thinking, you know, oh, here it is. It's all going to change. And by 1970, the air was coming out of the balloon. Now, that's not to say that there still wasn't a revolution going on or there wasn't turmoil. No, far from it. Actually, there was a lot of tumult happening in America and the world in 1970. And as it would turn out, it would continue throughout the early 70s and throughout the Nixon presidency. Of course, we all know how that ended with Watergate and everything else. So 1970, when you look back at it, is kind of a year that was, I don't want to say boring, I don't want to say dull, but compared to the craziness of the mid to late 60s, 1970 was just kind of in neutral. It's not bad, not good. There were some good things and a lot of bad things happening in America then. But, you know, everything gets kind of pushed to a crescendo in 68 and 69, and then it's just kind of floating out there. It's kind of like Wile E. Coyote after he runs off the cliff and he's just kind of there in midair and then he drops. You know, the Dropout in America is 72, 73, 74, 75. 1970 was, we just ran off the cliff and Coyote is just kind of hanging there. And it's reflected in music. You know, the music of 1970 is not as popping as, you know, some of the great rock songs of 68 and 69. It's represented well in Hollywood, in movies. Television was kind of at a creative standstill in 1970. Comedy, poetry, writing, literature, you know, it's, when you look back at American history and 1970, it's just kind of at a bizarre standstill. And I think when you look at the 1970 top set, it's in a bizarre standstill. You had some really creative sets in the mid-60s. You had some interesting sets in the late-60s, you know, a very simple, clean 66 and 67 set, the legendary burlap sack set of 1968, the simple yet colorful, kind of playful 69 top set, the one I call the yard sale sticker set because that's what it looks like, you know, a big colorful sticker just kind of stuck on the top with the player's name and, you know, the position that he's on, the colorful backs of the 69 top set, that kind of bubblegum pink and black. And then, you know, you got 1970. It's just kind of there. And then as you look forward, you have the very creative, bold 1971 set. You've got the garish 72 set. You've got the slightly more colorful 73 and 74, then you got the ultimate colorful 1975 set. And, you know, there's a lot of color to 76 as well. So it kind of, and it's not to say that Topps could predict the future, but I think, and again, with hindsight being 2020, I think they nailed it. you had the insanity of the 60s, and then we run off the cliff and we're in midair in 1970, and there's just kind of this pause. And with the 70 top set, there is a pause. It's very conservative. It's very basic. It's a little dull. It does have a little bit of color and pizzazz to it. It's on the back. But much like America was just in this floating in midair in slow motion moment that year, Tops produces a set that does the exact same thing. And I think it's pretty amazing when you look at it. Like I said, not that they could totally predict how 1970 and certainly the following few years would play out in life, but I think they really capture the thought and the moment of the time. Let's take a little sidebar here and bring in our guest, Nick D'Unti, as I mentioned, a product reviewer for Tops. And if you think that's interesting, his path into the hobby and back around to the hobby is interesting. And we're going to discuss not only the Heritage set, but also the new Tops set and also the Tops Living set, which I know a lot of listeners, they've been pushing me towards it. I'm still not a huge fan of it. That's not to say it's bad. It's not for me. It's not, at least not yet. Maybe I'll come around to it. But we'll talk about the Topps Living set and how that fits into all of the various sets that are out there. So I am pleased to be joined by educator, coach, and hobby specialist. We'll give him that title. I don't know if that's actually on his business card, but he is a fan of the program, and we welcome in Nick D'Unti. Thank you so much for joining us, Nick, and really appreciate your reaching out. You've got a lot of interesting stories to tell. And I think the most interesting one is kind of what you do in your spare time. By day, you're a teacher and a coach of boys volleyball in New York City. But then you jump into the phone booth, you take off your Clark Kent glasses, and you emerge as a hobby superhero. What is it that you do that is so unique to the hobby, and I'm sure would make a lot of our listeners envious of your little side project here?
Matt, thank you very much for having me on. And what I really think has been exciting about this part of the journey is being able to get back into the hobby by doing product reviews for Tops. And this has been going on since late 2015, and adding another corner to my baseball writing space on the internet. I've been able to connect with Tops and get service with their product and be able to sample all their issues and bring my 2 or 3 cents or 4 cents to the listeners and people who follow out there about each of their releases.
Now, you mentioned that you do some sports writing and baseball writing, and I would imagine you write your thoughts about some of these reviews. If people wanted to get your 2, 3, or 4 cents, where can they find some of your commentary? And then we'll talk a little more about that particular job that you have.
Sure. So on the web, we're at baseballhappenings.net. And for those that are following on social media, it's at Examine Baseball at Twitter and Instagram. And on Facebook, it is From the Stretch. And if you like audio, we're on the major platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, look at the Baseball Happenings podcast, and we're also on YouTube at Examine Baseball.
Excellent. So plenty of ways, whether it's through writing, listening, or watching, as the case may be. As you know, and you've got some broadcasting background, there's about a gazillion platforms that you have to be on if you've got a show, like yours or like mine, and it's ever growing. But that's good for the hobby. And for those who are collectors, I know they're all sitting there wondering, wait a minute, how did Nick become a product tester for Tops? And more importantly, how do I become one? Because it doesn't sound like a bad gig. I would imagine every few months you just get several packs or a box from Tops, and they're going, hey, we'd like your thoughts about this, and please spread the word for us.
Yeah, at the time I was actually writing for now defunct Examiner.com, which is was part of the social media title, and Examiner ranked really well in Google, and they got bought out by Axis Media. And so through them, I started writing my reviews through Examiner. And when Examiner went under around 2017, I had enough of a following through my social media and through Baseball Happening that, you know, Topps was so satisfied with the reach that we've had and that we've continued to expand. But, you know, this is not just like any collectors that look for freebies. I can go to Topps. I did have a established outlet and continued on with that following and showed that, you know, I was a reputable writer, not just someone that was like taking product and flipping it.
All right. So for those of you wondering if you can get a position like Nick has examining some of the releases for Topps, there is some experience required. That's often the part of the job application people go, oh. So, yeah, you can't just take it and hoard it for yourself. You have to have knowledge about the hobby and the sport and about Topps, I would imagine, and also have an audience that's willing to listen or watch or read what you're putting out there. So one more thought about this particular job that you have, reviewing products for Topps. How does that work? How often do they send you stuff? Is it specifically baseball, or are there other products that they send you every now and then?
You know, when I started out, they had a few other products. My first product was from football, but I think they gave up their football license, or they lost their football license, and so it is strictly baseball, and you know, the product hits retail first, and then after about a week after the hobby releases come out is when I'll get them in the mail. So as Topps' schedule starts to pick up steam as we go into the season, you know, the releases are coming more often, weekly, bi-weekly, as they go along. So there's always something in the mail to open up and go through and review. So Topps definitely keeps things busy as the season starts to heat up.
And Nick, you mentioned it takes a little bit of experience. You didn't just pick up a pack of baseball cards one day a few years ago and go, hey, I'm going to give Topps a call and see if I can help him out with this. Much like a lot of our listeners and yours truly, I'm sure this actually goes back many, many years. And you did say you got back into the hobby. So tell us a little bit about your collecting history. What got you into it?
Well, you know, like every other baseball craze kid that grew up in the 80s, baseball cards were synonymous with the culture of the game, with playing the game. You know, you're playing Little League and everyone has their baseball cards. And even earlier than that, you know, as an older family member, like, here's some of my old baseball cards. And so mid-1980s, I was introduced to them and, you know, we would always trade them on the block and, you know, look at each other's collections, and everyone thought that they were squirreling away their enough to, you know, pay for their college education. And so it was a really fun time as a kid growing up in the 1980s because the hobby was on such an upswing and baseball cards were ubiquitous. You know, teachers would take them away from us in school. So that's how I got my start into the hobby. And here in New York City, there was definitely not a shortage of shops. We had many where I lived in Queens within, you know, like a two-mile radius. There might have been four or five shops there. So there's always somewhere to go and, you know, pulling on mom's strings. Mom, can we go to the card store? And, you know, they'd wait outside, you know, for 10, 15 minutes while we go in and look and give us a few bucks to, you know, buy some cards. And that was really fun and exciting as a kid to get cards of the players that you tracked on TV. And even, you know, going through high school in the early 90s, cards were still fun. But then actually playing baseball started to take over. And I put a lot more time into playing the game and collecting. So the cards went to the side. And, you know, as we started moving in the 90s, with every brand making tons of releases, it got actually a little bit too difficult to keep up, and playing the game became more important than collecting it.
You kind of follow a similar path to myself. I know a lot of our listeners who are of our age group went through the same thing. You know, you collect in the mid to late 80s and early 90s. And, you know, it's funny, you get into high school, you become a teenager, and whether it's, you know, in your case, it's an athletic career, if you will, or it's, you know, girls distract you, or you buy a new car and you've got to fix it up, or, you know, you're busy doing a job, it pulls you away. But it was rather dubious timing for our generation with how the hobby was changing and how it just got too big and fat and bloated. So, you know, life kind of pulls you away from it, but the hobby starts turning you off. How long were you away from it, and what got you back into it? How did that happen?
You know, on the card collecting side, I would say it was probably about 10 or 11 years. So probably from like 97 to like 07, I didn't really touch cards that much, other than maybe to get the occasional autographs here or there. That part of the hobby for me didn't really fade. I always enjoyed getting autographs, but again, still playing baseball in college, then after college, you know, all of your time is really there. And then working and teaching, there's not a lot of time to run around and get autographs, but it was still fun being able to have some cards. You know, someone's doing a signing at a public appearance, or the occasional show when prices were still reasonable. It was still good that you had your library of stuff, that if you're like, oh, so-and-so's doing an appearance at this store grand open, it's like, all right, grab, you know, a few baseball cards, go down and you can get some stuff signed, and you can still send mail to players. And that was always exciting, to get letters back in the mail and, you know, 2-3 weeks later, some autographs waiting for the mail. So that part, while I still slowed down, I still had some memorabilia that way. But then, yeah, around like 2007 or so, going back online, you see people start talking about cards again, like, what are all these products, and Topps Heritage, and wow, these cards look like cards that I used to collect. And, you know, you went down to Target and bought a few packs, you're like, wow, this is interesting. And then, you know, there's all the chitter chatter on the internet, and it started slowly to pull me back into the hobby.
Nick Dienti of Baseball Happenings joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. I do want to talk a little bit about the base set for Topps and also the Heritage set, which is kind of, you know, the latter is kind of the main point of our podcast this week, the 1970 Topps set. But quickly about the 2019 base set for Topps. I said in a previous podcast, I really enjoy the design, first of all, because it's a little different than the previous 2 years. I think Topps tried to play it safe in 2018. They relied a little too much with some of the design effects from 2017. And they were good cards, but again, you know, let's shake it up a bit. But if you squint, there's a little bit of 1982 in those 2019 sets as well. What do you think of the overall base set this year?
Yeah, I noted that in my review as well, about that connection. And I liked the 2019 base set, and I gave it a very good review on the web. I thought there was like a lot of diversity in the design, and with the inserts. There was always something to keep you guessing while going through a box. And it was fun, you know. And that 150th anniversary logo, like, Topps was able just to kind of put the best of both worlds together with, you know, the now and the then, and I think that's a constant theme. But you look at this set, and it's crisp and, you know, pretty easy on the eyes. And you're right, they got away from what they did in 2017-18, and I think in a good way. So hopefully they took some of that feedback that they got from their customers, and, you know, was able to just update the design just enough that's like, all right, you have a different product this year with the flagship set.
Yeah, and I like what you said. It's fun, and there's a little bit of unexpectedness when you open up a pack. It's not as predictable. And I think, you know, some of the cards started getting predictable. I think they were still fun, but I think you go back to some of the Topps releases in the early 2000s. They were really struggling back then, and they weren't extremely fun. And you even go back to some in the collection, you go, boy, what was I all excited about back then? This is not a very good set. So, you know, Topps is still striking that balance on, you know, not only meeting collectors' expectations for big rookie cards and variations and inserts and stuff like that, but just making it a fun thing to go flipping through. I have been a big fan of the Heritage set for many years. Again, a lot of it goes back to my desire to collect vintage cards when I was even a teenager many moons ago. And I love the Heritage set this year because it nails the 1970 set to a T, including the inserts such as scratch-off cards, the cloth stickers as well. You know, really tries to, you know, get the feeling of 1970, and I think Topps has done that with every Heritage set for the last several years or so. I know that line or that product just came out last week, so I don't know how much has crossed your desk, but have you been able to get your hands on them, and what do you think of what Topps has put out in Heritage this year?
You know, your timing is excellent, because as I came home today, what was waiting in a box for me right on the step,
beauty,
was the Topps Heritage. So I haven't had a chance to open it yet, but that's going to be my weekend project, is to go through it and you know, with the power of the internet, I've gotten to see a lot of it that's online, and kind of anticipating some of these like variations and short prints, you know, that are coming through, and looking at the nuances that Thompson created, because they even recaptured the little minor or not so minor variations, and that's one thing with the Heritage set that keeps you like, you really have to look at every card in the pack, you know, to see what you're getting. And, you know, as much as collectors look at the macro with the cards, Thompson's managed to do this with a lot of their releases. You really got to look at everything on the card, the code, the little variation. You know, maybe there's a small way on the back where, you know, there's a serial number on the back, but it's not that easy to see. Mm-hmm. They did some with gum stains a few years ago, or like pseudo gum stains on the back of them. So I think Topps has put that in there where it's like you can't just flip through the cards. You got to spend some time with them. And with a set like Heritage, I think they make that with that idea in mind, that these cards are to be sat with, and maybe savored is the right word. You got to savor the cards a little bit here to see what you're actually getting in the pack.
Nick D'Anti from Baseball Happenings joining us. One other question about just the hobby in general, and it kind of plays off on the inserts and all this other stuff. It's so funny. One thing that drove a lot of us away from the hobby in the early to mid-90s was there were too many cards. There were too many manufacturers. Each set had four or five different offshoot brands. Each brand had certain inserts, you know, certain subsets. And on top of that, because the hobby was roaring, there were in some years literally 5 or 6 million of each individual card produced. So there's tens of millions of cards that are floating out there. But now you've got one company. It's Topps. They have a long-term agreement. I think it goes through 2025 now with the Major League Baseball Players Association and MLB. So if you're looking for more companies, it's not happening. But also, the irony of this is that even though there's one company that is in charge with the officially licensed product, you've got the base set, you've got Heritage, you've got Opening Day, you've got this one, you've got that one, you've got this one and that one and this one and that one. Topps has like 15 brands under the umbrella. Does it seem kind of ironic that what drove many of us away in some ways is getting us back? Maybe you don't like the base set, but you spend your money on Heritage or Bowman or one of the other brands instead?
You make another excellent point there, right? What we complained that there was too much to track down. It's like there's still too much to track down. And I think this is more of like the get-in-where-you-fit-in approach. You know who's delivering the product. And if you pay attention to the hobby, you know which shiny, sparkly thing catches your eye, and you can go for that. Like, I'm a fan of Stadium Club. I think the photography is excellent. A lot of people are driven to the Stadium Club line, and then they have the premium stuff. So if people are looking for, like, I just like autographs and relics, like, products like Triple Threads was to look at as well. So they've gotten a little bit past it. It's not just baseball cards now, because, you know, if you want your traditional baseball card set, you go for Heritage. You go for the flagship set. You want a little more photography, you're going for like Stadium Club. You want a kit friendly set, you can still go with Opening Day. You want something more high end, you can go with you know, Triple Threads. You know, they've tiered it a little bit so that, you know, people can get in at that thing that they like. And for some of the people out there, they want everything, and that's there too.
Nick, one last question. Speaking of product lines, what's your thoughts on the Topps Living set? And it's a set that I think is a brilliant idea from Topps. And I think modeling it after the very popular 1953 set design is good. Having a mix of current and former players is good. Having limited releases, it's a brilliant marketing decision, brilliant business decision. It's not for me, though. I don't know about your thoughts, and I know there are some people that love the Topps Living set, and they're still trying to hammer me into it. Maybe someday I'll buy some. But just your thoughts about that from a business perspective, and is that something that whets your appetite for a new set?
Well, I'm going to hit this from a few angles. I think from a business perspective, I like the idea that Topps is like a subscription model with it, and that, you know, people can subscribe to it and basically get every release like delivered to them, right? And so from Topps' way, if they could hook in a certain amount of collectors that way, that they know there's going to be a guaranteed consumer base for it, right? I think that works in their favor, and it is almost like, in essence, like print on demand, right? Like they have different runs for each set, and then, you know, you mentioned how they have the 53 design, right? And that hits in a few different ways. You go back to the people who really enjoy the classic 1953 design, and then people who are in our range that got brought back into it because, what, 93 when they did the Topps archives?
Yep.
And I still love that set, and I have probably at least 100 cards signed from that set from writing the players at the time, and a few that are, you know, still around. And so people look at that set a lot, and it was a really popular set to collect. And they brought it back in through a few years where there's been cards made in that design. And so they've been able to connect on that multiple times, and people are really familiar with that 53 design. So to see the new players in the old mold, that seems to be a big theme across Topps. And from the looks of online, there are some people that are just really, you know, really into it. And whether they're trying to get all of them or just their favorite players, it's like, oh, here's this new thing. You know exactly what you're getting when you buy. You don't have to take the risk of opening packs and hoping you get something. You can get this for, like you said, it's limited. There's not 300,000 copies or 500,000 copies. Like, there's like 3,000, you know. For me, but personally, I feel like that it too is not for me, just because, like, all these, like this, plus like the Topps Now type releases. I still think, like, long term, I don't know if this plays more into like the, you know, Instagram culture of like, take a picture of it, it's hot right now, but then like, you know, a few months later, people move on to it. And I'm curious to see, like, long term, are people going to come back to this set the way, like, you know, you come back to so many landmark Topps sets through, you know, your podcast. Are people really going to come back to the Topps Living? And with these like instantaneous type sets that are made, I tend to just like, I just want to watch because I question the staying power.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see the long term shelf life of it, but it's been going for what, about a year and a half now, and it's so far so good. So we'll see the sustainability of it, and it is interesting. I guess that's a downside of having a design just like the 53 Topps set. It's never going to change. And that's part of the fun of collecting, is that you can look at an old set and go, oh, that's from this year. And, you know, there's one way to define one set from the other, because one's going to look a little different than the other. So it'll be interesting to see over the next few years. Well, Nick, I appreciate your time and of course, appreciate your listening and the kind thoughts you've passed along to me. Let's reciprocate here again. How can people watch, listen, or read to your work and get the latest?
Thank you again. You can find us on the web at baseballhappenings.net, on most of the social media platforms, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, at Examine Baseball. We're on Facebook at From the Stretch. And if you want another podcast to listen to, of course, aside yours, you can check us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify. Look us up, Baseball Happenings Podcast.
There you go. Baseball Happenings Podcast. Nick Deonte joining us again on Wax Ecstatic this week. Thanks again. Happy collecting. And I'm serious. You're gonna love that package that you received in the mail. Happy unwrapping of the Heritage set this year.
Thank you very much. I look forward, and thank you for having me on the show. And to all the people that listen, thank you for your time.
So thanks again to Nick for joining us. It was a real pleasure, and hopefully you're able to follow him, listen to his podcast as well, and check out his reviews of some of the new Topps products. And as he mentioned, basically he gets a package from Topps whenever a new product rolls out. Here we are, it's spring. He's going to be getting some of this stuff basically every few weeks from Topps, and I'm certain that you'll enjoy his two cents that he can offer on some of the newer cards that are coming out these days. All right, let's wrap up our thoughts on the 1970 Topps set by talking about some of the players from the Topps set. I don't have too many 1970 Topps cards. I have maybe about 25, not a whole lot. But I did select a few from my binder. And I wanted to tell the story of a few of these players that we have here, including Al Weiss. Al Weiss is beloved by longtime Mets fans. And if you look at his career stats, you're thinking, why? Al Weiss had a career batting average of .219. He hit 7 home runs, batted in 115 runners, and that's about it, right? Well, no. Al Weiss was one of the key cogs of the Mets' miracle 1969 World Series run, and he's featured in the 1970 set as a member of the Mets. And as Nick will tell you, he's from Queens. So you're surrounded by Mets fans in Queens, and the 1970 top set is a popular one with Mets fans because you get to see all the heroes from the 1969 team in that set. And I would imagine it's the same for the 87 top set as you look back at the 86 world champion Mets. Well, anyways, Al Weiss, a native of Franklin Square, New York, grows up in Bethpage, goes to Farmingdale High School. He is a high school teammate of Jack LeMabe, who would later become a major league pitcher and would be a teammate of Weiss's with the Chicago White Sox in the mid-60s. Weiss joined the U.S. Navy, played baseball in the Navy, and did so well as an infielder that some teammates reached out to people that they knew, and one of them happened to be a scout for the Chicago White Sox. And the Sox signed him to a contract as an amateur free agent in 1959, very quickly moves up their ladder and starts playing for the White Sox in 1962. Pretty much, I don't want to say utility infielder, but that was kind of how he got his career started, splitting time at second and third base. Nellie Fox gets traded in 1964, and Weiss becomes pretty much the regular second baseman at Comiskey Park at that time. Still does a little time as shortstop. But as the White Sox continue to churn through infielders, they bring in Don Buford eventually, and Buford becomes the regular starting second baseman. Well, Weiss becomes expendable, and he is moved in a deal to the Mets following the 1967 season, along with teammate Tommy Agee, another key part of that 69 Mets team, in exchange for Tommy Davis, Jack Fisher, Buddy Booker, and Billy Winn. Now again, Weiss is a utility infielder for the Mets. Bud Harrelson and Ken Boswell are your primary second baseman and shortstop tandem at the time, but Al Weiss would have his impact felt not only in the regular season, but in the World Series too. I said that Weiss had only 7 career home runs, while 2 of them were rather fortuitously featured in the 1969 season, as he hit 2 of them in 2 separate games, a total of 2 home runs, 1 each in 2 games, against the Chicago Cubs at a key series in the middle of the 69 season in July of 1969 as the Mets are chipping away at the Cubs' lead in the National League East. And he would have some key hits and key plays throughout the season, so much so that Mets manager Gil Hodges started relying on Weiss more in the middle infield than again, Ken Boswell or Bud Harrelson, really more at the detriment of Harrelson. But Harrelson took it in stride because, hey, the team's winning, so he went along with it. Weiss, by the way, also part of a rather dubious moment in Mets history that season, as he made an error in the bottom of the 24th inning in Houston in the longest major league game on record. The Houston Astros would go on to win that game, thanks in part to the snafu at shortstop. But hey, it was the 24th inning, so it's okay. It happens. But anyways, he's remembered more for hitting some key home runs down the stretch. Doesn't really have much of an effect for the Mets in the 69 NLCS against the Braves, But he would have a key home run again in Game 5 of the World Series. The Mets are up 3-1 at that point in time. So the Orioles have a 3-0 lead. Don Clendenin hits a 2-run homer in the 6th inning. And then leading off in the 7th, Weiss takes eventual Cy Young Award winner Dave McNally deep to tie the game. The Mets would score a couple more runs in the 8th inning. And then they clinch the series with that win. So Weiss is forever remembered as that guy who came up with a key home run several times throughout the 1969 season and playoffs. He was actually named the Babe Ruth Award winner. It was given out by the Baseball Writers Association of America, and the award has been changed a little bit. It's, you know, back then it was basically the BBWA's MVP of the World Series. Well, now, so that it doesn't overshadow the World Series MVP award, it's kind of a postseason MVP award that is still given out. And that's kind of been the situation, I want to say, for 10 or 11 years now. But the World Series MVP and the Babe Ruth Award were often the same person, the same recipient got them. Well, Weiss got the Babe Ruth Award in 1969 for his heroics in the 69 series. In fact, he batted 455 with 3 RBI and had that big home run in Game 5. Don Clendenin gets the World Series MVP. So it was one of only a few times in the history of the World Series that the MVP and the Babe Ruth Award went to different recipients. More often than not, it was the same award going to the same person. So he will forever be remembered as that unsung hero, and the Mets had a lot of them. Not only Clendenin, but also, we mentioned Tommy Agee. You know, Ed Charles, roving utility infielder, had some key plays. J.C. Martin, the same thing. You know, the Mets had a lot of them. You always think of Tom Seaver and Nolan Ryan and Tug McGraw and, you know, all these other luminary players from that 69 team. But it was a lot of the role players who stepped up their role and created something magical that 1969 season. Now, another reason why Weiss is remembered so well is so soon after those heroics, his career basically slid off the edge, and that was pretty much it. The Mets had a prospect by the name of Tim Foley, who came up through the system, became a regular infielder in 1970. And after 1971, the end of the line was showing up for Al Weiss. It should also be mentioned, even though he was kind of a nondescript utility infielder, he was highly sought after by Gil Hodges, who was very influential in making that trade or getting that trade done heading into the 1968 season. Remember, Hodges was manager of the Washington Senators before he became the manager of the Mets in 1968. And he had seen Weiss at his best as a utility infielder and as a starter with the White Sox while Hodges was there in Washington earlier on. So what's happening with Al Weiss at last check, and thanks to the people at Sabre for doing this, a family man who is doing an awful lot of golfing these days. Well, God bless him. You know, if you got the time to do it, by all means, do it. Now, another card that I pulled here, Don Shaw, and it turned out that Don Shaw was actually a teammate of Al Weiss briefly in 1968. And in fact, Don Shaw was drafted by the Mets and came up through the Mets farm system as a highly touted left-handed relief pitcher. In fact, he took the advice of Eddie Stanky, who was very high up in the Mets farm system at the time in the mid-60s, to focus on becoming a relief pitcher, because while he had some quality stuff, didn't quite have the endurance to stand out as a starting pitcher. Also, if you think about the starting pitchers that were in the Mets farm system at the time, you had Tom Seaver and Nolan Ryan and Jerry Kuzman and also Tug McGraw, who was being groomed as a starter, of course, would later become a closer. But, thankfully for Don Shaw, he listened to Eddie Stanky, became a highly touted prospect in the Mets system. But with all the quality arms that the Mets had, not only at the major league level, but in the minor league level. He was exposed in the expansion draft, and he was snapped up by the Montreal Expos in the 20th, or with the 20th pick. And Don Shaw is in the record books as being the first pitcher credited with a win in Montreal Expos history. It came in relief, ironically, against the Mets at Shea Stadium in April of 1969. So Don Shaw in the record books as the first pitcher to notch a win in the history of the Montreal Expos. Due to some injury issues and also, you know, the Expos roster turning over and over a lot in the early years, he bounced around a little bit, went on to the St. Louis Cardinals, had a slight career revival there, but again, battling injury issues, wasn't able to stick around for a long time. Appeared with the Oakland Athletics in 1972, was not on their postseason roster, and later went to the Detroit Tigers, where he had a very brief major league career and pretty much had his career wrap up in the minor leagues in Toledo before the age of 30. Now, he became a regional manager for an employee benefits company and was involved in the insurance business for many, many years. And again, thanks to Sabre doing a little research here. As of last note, and this was a few years ago, living in St. Louis, still running his own health insurance agency. An interesting note, too, about Don Shaw. When he was with the Mets, he was almost part of the trade that brought Tommy Agee and Al Weiss to the White Sox, or from the White Sox to the Mets. The White Sox heavily coveted him, but again, he was such a highly touted prospect for the Mets at the time, he was not part of the deal. So that's one of the fun thing about baseball cards, is you can have just these two random common cards in the same plastic page, yet these two players, even though they had different career arcs, were very tightly tied together, both playing for the Mets in 1968, both almost involved in the same trade in what would have been for one another, and both notching their own marks in history. Al Weiss as a World Series hero and Don Shaw as the pitcher of record for the first win in Montreal Expos history. Now, I've got a fun card here, the Houston Astros future prospects. I always love the future prospects cards because you always get some kind of interesting story behind them. And there's an interesting story, too, of the word Astros being used on a baseball card. If you look carefully at the 1968 and 69 top sets, Astros players are not labeled as Astros players. It just says Houston. And I think I've shared the story before, but the reason why that happened is because at the time, the Astros baseball club was in a lawsuit with the Monsanto company. Monsanto, of course, created AstroTurf. And there was a trademark battle between Monsanto and AstroTurf and the Houston Astros, who were playing on AstroTurf. And I believe the story goes that Topps didn't want to get involved in the trademark fight, so they kind of stood on the sidelines and got around it by referring to Astros players as simply players with Houston. So take a look at that. Next time you've got a stack of 68 or 69 Topps cards, you'll notice that the Astros players aren't called Astros. It just says Houston on their cards. Well, the lawsuit and all the other issues were taken care of by 1970. As you can see, Topps referring to the Astros players as Astros. And we've got a double rookie card here featuring John Mayberry and Bob Watkins, two players that couldn't have had more different paths in their major league careers. Let's start with John Mayberry. If you're a longtime viewer of ESPN, you know that Chris Berman would refer to John Mayberry as John Mayberry RFD. Of course, a reference to Mayberry RFD, a spinoff show of the Andy Griffith Show from the 1960s. Well, Mayberry is one of the star players for the Astros that got away. And when you think of Mayberry and you think of Rusty Staub and you think of Joe Morgan, the Astros let a lot of really good players get away in the early 1970s. And that is certainly the case for John Mayberry, who was a very talented baseball, basketball, and football player from Michigan. He was from the Detroit area, real standout. He was a first-round draft selection of the Astros in 1967, very quickly moving up the ladder in the Houston system, and is actually performing in the major leagues as early as 1968. He was a call-up in the 68 season. It was amazing how they were just messing around with this guy and his skill set early on in his career. He was a prototypical first baseman. He was a power hitter. You know, he was your power on the corner player. Yet the Astros wanted to use him as more of a small ball slap hitter. Now, maybe that's in part because you had the Astro turf at the Astrodome and they were looking for more of a speed game. But, you know, speed and slap hitting, just contact hitting, was not John Mayberry's style of play. So Mayberry was very much misused in that sense. And finally, push came to shove, and the Astros decided to trade him to the Royals in a very lopsided deal. Heading into the 1971 offseason, the Astros send him and a prospect named Dave Grangard, and Grangard didn't really amount to much in the major leagues. Well, they sent both of those players to Kansas City for Lance Clemens and Jim York. Suffice to say, a very one-sided deal, with the Royals being victors in that trade. And in fact, Mayberry, who his power was used and was certainly utilized in the very spacious confines of Kauffman Stadium, or, you know, what was then called Royal Stadium at the time, he became a two-time All-Star, 1973 and 1974. Speaking of power and stadiums in Kansas City, it should be noted that John Mayberry hit the final Royals home run in the old Municipal Stadium. The Royals last played there in 1972. Gene Tennis hit the last home run there for visiting Athletics. But yeah, John Mayberry in the history books with that little notation, as I mentioned, two-time All-Star, became a big factor in the Royals' very quick growth from expansion club in 1969 to contender, in fact, playoff team in 1976. But it was in the playoffs in 1977 where Mayberry drew the ire of manager Whitey Herzog. Apparently, Mayberry was out late, not very focused on the task at hand and trying to defeat the Yankees in the American League Championship Series. And Mayberry was actually benched prior to, I believe it was game four of the series, and the Yankees would go on to win the series and ultimately go on to win the World Series over the Dodgers just a few weeks later. And Whitey Herzog was just so incensed over John Mayberry, who he blamed the loss of the series to the Yankees to, that Herzog wanted Mayberry gone. So the Royals helped Whitey Herzog out and, in a sense, help out Mayberry, in the sense that they, you know, get him into a position away from a very angry manager. The downside for Mayberry was that he was traded to the Toronto Blue Jays. And the Blue Jays in the late 70s, of course, as an expansion team, pretty terrible team. And he was one of the few stars of the Blue Jays, as he would clobber quite a few home runs in the tight confines of Exhibition Stadium, was utilized mostly at first base, but sometimes in a designated hitter role. And as the Blue Jays started getting prospects through their system, notably Willie Upshaw at first base, it was time for the Jays to move on from John Mayberry, and they moved him to the Yankees midway through 1982. His playing career then ended shortly thereafter, and he would go on to serve as a coach for several organizations, also an ambassador for the Royals. He was inducted into the Royals Hall of Fame in 1996. So even though it was a very bitter departure at the hands of Whitey Herzog in Kansas City, Mayberry and the Royals organization able to make amends over the few years after his career ended. Now, the name John Mayberry may ring a bell for some listeners, as in John Mayberry Jr., who played from 2009 to 2015, mostly in the Philadelphia Phillies organization. Now, interesting story about the other name on the card here. So we have John Mayberry, but also Bob Watkins. And Watkins is not to be confused with Bob Watson, who was also with the Astros, became the first African-American general manager in Major League history, not only with Houston, but was very influential in the Yankees' rise to legendary status in the mid to late 1990s. He was a big, big part of that. Not to be confused. In fact, Bob Watson and Bob Watkins were on totally different ends of the spectrum when it came to their playing days. Bob Watkins, who is featured on this card along with John Mayberry, never really saw his potential fulfilled in the major leagues. In fact, if you flip the card over, the line that is on there from the 1969 season, that is it. And I cannot find anything about the pitcher, Bob Watkins, ever since his time, as brief as it was in the major leagues. Now, there's an orthopedic surgeon named Bob Watkins, but that's somebody that's completely different here. Bob Watkins, as far as I can tell, is still alive. He's 70 years old. He was born in San Francisco. He was a hot prospect for the Astros, was a star at Dallas-Fort Worth, which at the time, the Dallas-Fort Worth Spurs, I believe, was their name. They were, you know, the AAA club for the Astros in the late 60s. And he had some really strong stints there, had that cup of coffee in 1969 with the parent club, but lasted in the minor leagues only a couple more seasons afterwards. And he was out of professional baseball shortly after he was in it. So a very odd story there, because, you know, even players who don't have very lengthy careers, you could normally find some story about them or a where are they now. But that is not the case for Bob Watkins. So as quickly as he came, he left, and is certainly the diametrical opposite of John Mayberry Sr., who had a very lengthy career in Major League Baseball, playing from 1968 through 1982, and having a pretty profound effect on the up-and-coming Royals and certainly the early days of the Toronto Blue Jays. All right, a couple more cards here from the 1970 collection. A big name in Detroit for a very long time, Mickey Stanley, also known as Mitchell Jack Stanley. But Mickey Stanley was a mainstay in the outfield at Tiger Stadium for many, many years, is a unique link between the 1968 and 1984 World Champion Tigers. I'll get to that in a little bit. But you may notice, if you look at this card, it says shortstop-outfield. And in 1970, when this card was created, Mickey Stanley was still considered a shortstop at times, thanks to that 1968 World Series and the actions of Tigers manager Mayo Smith. Going into the 68 World Series, Smith didn't really feel comfortable about having Ray Oyler, who was a competent fielder but not a very good hitter, didn't want Oyler going up against Bob Gibson and Steve Carlton and the great arms that the St. Louis Cardinals had. So prior to the series starting, Smith calls Mickey Stanley into his office and doesn't ask him, just flat out tells him, "You're playing shortstop in the World Series." So Stanley, who was a coach's dream because he would do anything for the team, gladly took the challenge and was an absolute stud at shortstop for much of that series. In fact, Oyler, I believe, only had one at-bat in the entire seven-game series. Stanley, you know, his bat was put to good use, but also his fielding prowess was on exhibit throughout the World Series and helped Detroit nail down that series over the defending champion Cardinals. And there were some thoughts that maybe Stanley would stay at shortstop for good. In fact, Oyler was picked up by the Seattle Pilots in the expansion draft in 1969, but it would turn out that it was not very smart for him to stay at shortstop long term. So it was a rather productive and timely experiment, but Yeah, that was pretty much it. He went back out into the outfield. And, you know, there are a lot of outstanding outfielders for Detroit during Stanley's time there. Of course, you had Al Kaline, Willie Horton, Jim Northrup. You can't forget about him. Later on, Kaline dealing with injuries. Of course, the designated hitter rule comes in, so he was able to be utilized there. The Tigers did have Hondo, Big Frank Howard, for a little bit. And he was sometimes platooned in the outfield or the DH position. And it seemed like Stanley's days with the Tigers would end when Ron LaFleur was coming up through the system. But again, Stanley was willing to play anywhere, do any part for the team, not really haggle with contract negotiations. So that was an absolute dream for management as well. And before his career was all said and done in 1978, he would appear in 15 seasons for the Detroit Tigers. Now, I mentioned that he had a unique link from the 68 to the 84 team, and you may be wondering, well, how is that possible if his career ended in 1978 and the Tigers were not a very good team in the late 70s? Well, the connection is he made an acrobatic catch to preserve Jack Morris's first major league win. I believe that was in 77, I want to say. And that's a very unique link there. But also, he was a very steady professional presence for a lot of the up-and-coming prospects for the Tigers. Not only Jack Morris, but you had Lance Parrish and Lou Whitaker and Alan Trammell. You know, a lot of those key players for not only that 1984 team, but for much of the Detroit Tigers' mostly successful teams throughout the 1980s. He was a very big part in the leadership core for the young guys, such as those that I mentioned. Also, he's got a very infamous line about Nolan Ryan. Ryan no-hit the Tigers in 1973, and Stanley was quoted as saying afterwards, "Those were the best pitches I ever heard." That's just how dominant Nolan Ryan was back in the day. And lastly, for the haters, I pulled out a dreaded manager card for you, and it is Dave Bristol. It's rather ironic. One of our listeners had the box topper card from a Heritage box, and the box topper card was Lum Harris, who was the Atlanta Braves manager in 1969. And I said, well, I'm not interested unless it's Dave Bristol. Ironically, Bristol would be a manager for the Braves later on. But I will tell a little story about Dave Bristol here, because it is unique with him being the manager of, as the card says, the Seattle Pilots. In reality, it was the Milwaukee Brewers. But, you know, Dave Bristol owes his managing career to some success in the minor leagues and a little bit of a Chinese fire drill in Cincinnati in the mid-60s, but he was always a hard luck manager. And I say that in the sense that he was always with teams that were kind of in rebuilding mode more often than not. So he had a pretty lengthy managing career, would be a manager from 1966 through 1980, not consecutively through all those years. There were some years where he was a base coach, but he was a manager for most of those years. And as I said, he had a lot of success in the minor leagues, notably with the San Diego Padres when they were the Pacific Coast League affiliate of the Cincinnati Reds. And after Fred Hutchinson died from cancer in 1964, the Reds were just going through managers. They couldn't quite settle in on the right manager. And heading into the 1966 season, they had Don Hefner, who was a rookie manager. But the Reds stumbled out of the gate, and Bristol was part of the coaching staff. Well, the Reds decided to remove Hefner as the manager in July of that season, and Bristol became the head guy and would be there through 1969. Now, the reason why Hefner and Bristol struggled is because prior to the 1966 season, you had the infamous and lousy, lopsided trade of Frank Robinson to the Baltimore Orioles for a package of players. The head guy there was Milt Pappas, and nothing against Milt Pappas. In fact, the trade at the time made sense, but Pappas didn't live up to expectations. None of the other players were key parts of Cincinnati, who, you know, the Reds were a contending team for much of the early 60s, and they got close in 1965. They gave the Dodgers a good run, but this deal really just knocked the bottom out. Like I said, Pappas didn't live up to expectations. The other players didn't help matters. And then on top of that, Frank Robinson, who was remarked as an, you know, over 30 player, you know, the Reds were just like, yeah, he's not as good as he used to be. Well, Robinson had the last laugh, of course, winning the Triple Crown and the World Series in 1966, and he would win another series with the Orioles in 1970. Appeared actually in four World Series with them, as the Orioles were also in the Fall Classic in 1969 and 1971. So, you know, Dave Bristol, that was kind of, you know, hard luck situation number one in his managing career, where, you know, he finally got the break that was deserved of him, but given the management moves and, you know, just, you know, the Reds on the edge of contention and then just kind of falling off the edge, yeah, he wasn't able to do much about it. And I don't think any manager could do that, whether it was, you know, Bristol or Hefner or, you know, Dick Sizzler was there the year before. They just couldn't put it all together. When Bristol left following the 1969 season, Sparky Anderson was hired, also from, as I mentioned earlier, from the Major League Baseball San Diego Padres. And during Bristol's early days, the Reds are bringing up some stalwarts, some cornerstones of the Big Red Machine. You had Johnny Bench and Davey Concepcion and Tony Perez. And, of course, Pete Rose was already an established star. And, you know, a lot of the big pieces of the Big Red Machine were coming together in the late 60s, and they would become a dominant force throughout the 1970s. So Bristol then is brought into Seattle. And, of course, the Pilots in 1969 were just an absolute disaster. For more on the Seattle Pilots, because for the interest of time, I can't talk too much about them in this show. But if you go back through our archives, look for our podcast featuring 1969 Tops, and our random poll from that podcast was for a Pilots player named Jack Aker. He was a pitcher for them. And I go into much greater detail about the Seattle Pilots and the rather odd situation that the Pilots are, and they're still much loved today, because I don't think you'll ever see another team in any sport, never mind Major League Baseball, any sport, that lives for just one season and then goes away. The only other comparable suggestion that I can come up with is the Philadelphia Quakers in the NHL, and this is in the early 1930s. They were a terrible team, and they only lasted one season. Although, unlike the Pilots, the Quakers just went away completely. They disbanded, while the Pilots eventually moved to Milwaukee. And, you know, Bristol was put in a tough position, because he is, you know, heading down to spring training, and the Pilots, you know, at the start of spring training, are going back to Seattle. But one of my favorite stories about the Seattle Pilots is, as the bankruptcy procedure is going on during spring training, and as the team is completely bankrupt and has to be sold to Bud Selig, and Selig is going to eventually move them to Milwaukee, at the end of spring training, the Pilots' equipment truck is just sitting in Arizona waiting to find out, where are they going? You know, they had all the gear packed up, and they didn't know, all right, are we driving back to Seattle, or are we heading to Milwaukee? And, of course, they would go to Milwaukee, because the move happened quite literally days before the 1970 season started. The Brewers basically just took the old Pilots uniforms, changed the lettering on there. You know, instead of spelling Pilots, it said Brewers. That is why the Brewers team colors are blue and gold. Selig originally wanted them to be blue and red in homage to the minor league Brewers of the American Association of many, many years. But Dave Bristol, again, hard luck. He's stuck with this bad team that is now just shoved into Milwaukee. The city of Milwaukee was not quite as appreciative of the Sad Sack Pilots moving in. They were still a little bitter over the Braves' departure from a few years before. So he's the manager of the up-and-coming but struggling Brewers teams of the early 70s. As I mentioned, he was a manager for the Atlanta Braves, 1976 and 77. Hey, you had some talented players then, but you also had the first couple of seasons of Ted Turner as the owner of the team. And Dave Bristol was the manager in 1977 who got kicked aside by Ted Turner. In fact, Bristol was, quote unquote, put on assignment as a scout, while Ted Turner put on a uniform for one game in Pittsburgh and declared himself manager. And he was supposed to be manager for a couple of weeks, but the National League dropped the hammer on that and said, no, you can't do that. So, you know, it was an embarrassing situation for Bristol, who eventually, you know, gets kicked to the side, you know, in regards to his managerial experience. Goes to San Francisco, the Giants, another team that was rebuilding and not very good, 1979 and 1980. And he eventually yields to, ironically, you ready for this? Frank Robinson, who had become the manager of the Giants in 1981. So it's funny how Frank Robinson is part of the beginning of the managerial career of Dave Bristol, but also the end of it as well. We should mention that Dave Bristol is alive and kicking, by the way, at 85 years young. He'll be 86 this summer. And he was recently inducted into the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame. Now, beyond the managerial time, like I said, he was also a coach, not only with the Reds for a couple seasons, but also a few stints with the Phillies in the 1980s. So there you go, a very interesting look at some very interesting cards from 1970 Tops. As I said earlier, if you get a chance to buy some of these cards, even if they're you know, on the cheap, go ahead and do it, because 1970 Tops, again, I think really encapsulates what's going on in America and in baseball. Some changing times for both the nation and the sport, and as it turned out, the hobby in 1970. As a new decade was getting underway and there were a lot more questions than answers in life and in baseball at the time. So that'll do it on a very packed program. My thanks again to Nick Deonte for joining me earlier on in the program. And I certainly hope you can catch his podcast and his writings as well at your convenience. And I hope you enjoy the Topps Heritage product that is out there now as much as I have. And again, check out the 1970 set too if you get the opportunity. I think it is well worth your time to you know, invest in it just a little bit. And it is relatively affordable, again, as long as you're not too concerned about condition, because again, a lot of cards are off center. But other than the Thurman Munson rookie card, that's really the only one that's going to punch a hole in your pocket. You could still get some pretty good deals, even on some of the early career cards, such as Nolan Ryan and also Reggie Jackson and some of the other key young stars from the mid to late 60s. You could put together a nice little set of an underrated and underappreciated set from Topps that was released in 1970. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for tuning into Wax Ecstatic. Make sure you check us out on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains. Make a cash donation to help keep the program alive and well at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And be on the lookout for our next podcast 2 weeks from today, Friday, March the 22nd. It'll come your way at noon Eastern. And we will catch you on the next Wax Ecstatic. Thanks again for listening.